All right, so continuing our discussion from the previous weeks, we're picking up in the ninth ikar, the ikar of habitol, of the fact that the Torah will not be altered, will not be changed, will not be canceled. It's right there. So just to tie up a number of loose ends, we may still have one more week discussing one more tangential topic to this ikar, but at least for the main point of the ikar, to tie up the loose ends this week, we're going to talk about a couple of things. We're going to talk about why this ikar is so necessary, and then we're going to try and address some of the questions that are asked, some of the challenges that are posed to this ikar. There are a lot of very technical, specific questions. We're only going to try and address the questions which are relevant to this class, the nature of this class, which is understanding the significance and the message of the ikrim. There are other, you know, questions that are, you know, there's a question and answer, but they're not so central to understanding the ikar. They more have to deal with how you learn that gemara over there and how you understand that talk over there, and they're not as central to our discussion so much as they are in terms of how you'll understand various other points. So we won't be addressing those as much. I'll mention them just so everyone could, you know, be exposed to them, but we're not going to spend as much time as those. But so let's start with the tzorech of this ikar. So on the front page of the source here, I just put the Rambam again, just so everyone knows what we're talking about. But so the ikar, like we said, is the ikar that the Torah is not going to be changed; that the Torah is permanent. So the two aspects of the significance of this point. So we talk about it from two perspectives. We'll talk about it from just the significance in terms of appreciating what it means for our understanding of relationship with the Kadosh Baruch Hu, one aspect of the importance of the Ikrim, and also understand how it fits into the rubric that we've discussed since the beginning, which is the idea that the Ikrim are meant to form the structure in which mitzvos are binding. They all contribute in some way to address a potential weak link in emuna, in accepting the mitzvos, addressing some way in which a person would justify for themselves why they don't have to keep mitzvos. So just first, in terms of the appreciation for ourselves, the ninth ikar is what says that the Torah is emes muchlat, that it's absolute truth. The Torah is not just a convenience, something expedient for, you know, God gave a list of things which, you know, that's for now what he decided we should do, but, you know, of course it could have been other things, and of course, you know, it's at a certain point this was important, but it's not necessarily going to be important later. The fact that the Torah will not be changed tells us that the Torah is absolute truth. It's objectively part of the reality of existence. Something we've talked about before, histakel bo raisa ubara alma, that God looked into the Torah and created the world. The Torah is not just the conventions that God decided to tell us about, but it is absolute truth. It's objective. There's objective value to mitzvos. It's the first point is just in terms of the significance of what the Torah is. The fact that it will not be nullified tells us that it is more than just the list of things that God told us to do, but that it is God revealing to us the list of objective values and point those things which are objectively significant in creation. In terms of the shibud, in terms of the subjugating ourselves to mitzvos. So, two points I want to make. And as I'm about to make this point, see that there's one thing that I meant to print off this morning to bring in just to read, but I'll just have to say it instead of reading it. But dovetailing off of the point we made before, a person will not be completely meshabed themselves to something subjective. A person will, the fact that there's star, the fact that there's reward, if we would say, the Torah is the list of things that God decided for now you should do, and he said, I'll reward you for doing them. Why are you doing them? Well, because God said he's going to pay you for doing it. A person does not subjugate themselves. A person does not absolutely submit themselves. A complete bittul, a complete hishtabdus, a complete submission to something which they know really has no intrinsic value. When it comes time to cut corners, they'll tell themselves, okay, so you know what? I'll lose a little bit of schar for this. At the end of the day, you know, there's nothing intrinsically valuable about this, and therefore it doesn't make a difference if I take shortcuts. So you know, an employee. So he wants the work to get paid, but at the end of the day, getting paid is just getting paid. And if you know, finds corners to cut. He finds, you know, he thinks he can get away with, he's gonna try and get away with. You're not meshabed yourself in an absolute way to something which you don't feel has absolute value. As the first point is just as an underlying psychological point of view, that if we that to understand that the Torah is not just conventions, but it is things that have absolute value. So that's the first point, and that it's going to be necessary to know in order to be meshabed for a person to submit themselves to the Torah. An additional point, a person, we would say that the Torah is, it's for now, but it could be changed, a person will tell himself that it isn't so important to keep the Torah because he's going to find out later that it gets changed and find out that what he was doing before, you know, that wasn't really the he was doing it wrong. Now I just want to point out something about this. For a long time, I didn't realize this point. I just found this out recently. In Christian philosophy, this is what I wanted to bring in, a little paragraph from Dante, from Dante's Inferno, the Divine Comedy. From Dante's Inferno is a paragraph somewhere near the beginning, somewhat close to the beginning, where they're in the first level of whatever they call it, purgatory or hell or wherever is taking Dante into, where he's meeting a number of people, who, including, you know, philosophers and whatever it was, his tour guide tells him, these people, they're here because they didn't really do anything that bad, but they happened to live before Yashka came along, and therefore they didn't know how to serve God properly. It wasn't until Yashka came along that he told everyone the right way to serve God and to, you know, how to relate, I guess, you know, through himself or whatever their philosophy is. But if you lived before Yashka, so it's unfortunate for you. You didn't have the keys, the access tools in order to serve God properly, and therefore, you know, you're stuck over here in the first circle of Gehenna. So they actually hold not just that God changed his mind and decided, you know, it used to be this was the right thing to do, now this is the right thing to do. It's more than that. They say that it was revealed retroactively that you really never had the right answer anyways. All along, it was really something else. And that's exactly the point. If you believe that something is going to come along later and replace it, and not only just replace it, but trump it and say that, you know what, now it's Nisgala, now it's been revealed that this was really the right way to do it. And all along, you know, you were, you know, I don't know, God was playing like a cruel joke. I don't know exactly what they would say, but this is what they say. But that that what I did before now really had no value. So a person will tell themselves, if that's true, even before it gets changed, a person is going to tell himself, by those mitzvos that he doesn't want to keep, will tell himself, why should I bother? I'm just going to find out in a couple weeks, a couple years, whatever it is, that, you know, that a couple of them, but eventually, you know, it'll become clear that, you know, this wasn't really the right way to do it anyways, so why should I bother sacrificing everything for this? It's, you know, eventually it's just going to get changed anyways. And even if you don't say, like the Christian philosophy, that eventually it was revealed that the way they used to serve God was wrong, even if you say that God for now, you know, this is what he wants for now, he'll change his mind. When he changes his mind, it doesn't invalidate what was before. It just, you know, from now on he wants something different. Even in that school of thought, even if you look at it that way, there still is a shortcoming, which is, and remember, we're talking about how people justify to themselves, how a person will justify to it to himself is that, you know, these things, God gave a list of mitzvos. They were relevant back then. God, you know, he probably would change it. He probably has plans to change it or whatever it is. But you know what? We don't have Nevi'im nowadays. We don't have prophets nowadays. And therefore, you know, we're not on the level for God to reveal himself to us like that. And therefore, God, you know, like Nebuch, it's, there's we're incapable of receiving that revelation. But I know that, you know, Shabbos is for sure out of date. You know, back then, you know, Shabbos made a lot of sense before you had electricity and computers and you know, an industrial revolution. Shabbos made a lot of sense. But, you know, today, like, I'm going to not rest by, you know, taking a 3-mile hike up the hill instead of, you know, just pressing the gas pedal. That's my day of rest. Ha, ha, ha. Right? That for sure is out of date. That's what a person will tell themselves. Oh, so why doesn't God come and tell us? Because, you know, we're not Zocha. We don't merit to have God come and reveal himself to us. But, of course, God would tell us that, you know, whichever mitzvos I see as being archaic and outdated are, you know, those ones are the ones that are meant to be replaced. First, that's important. The person has to know that, no, the Torah is permanent and eternal. A person cannot see why something, you know, it happens to be Shabbos is an interesting example. Anyone who's keeping Shabbos knows that there was probably never a time when Shabbos was as relevant as it was today. I was actually at an outreach organization had a Shabbaton recently, and on Motzi Shabbos by their little Havdalah Malav Malka type of thing, so they offered anyone who wants to just share their thoughts so about you know, about the Shabbaton. It was really their first experience of Shabbos for many of them, and one of them, you know, pipes up and says, you know, it was such a refreshing experience. We spend our entire lives being plugged in, and to, you know, have one day where, you know, to disconnect, it was so refreshing to, like, connect with myself. That's the Shabbos nowadays is like the oasis of time that a person has to actually connect with themselves. We spend so much time being connected to the world. You say, you know, you take our smartphones into the bathroom because, you know, we can't have, you know, those 6 minutes where we're not, you know, checking our email or, you know, looking at the news. We have no time. That's for ourselves. Shabbos is one time where we actually disconnect and you have time that you actually spend really connecting with yourself and with other people. So if we didn't have the wisdom of the Torah telling us that this is permanent, we wouldn't have the foresight to appreciate that the things in the Torah are eternal. We would reject it, because if you look at it very superficially, it does seem like it's outdated. It's the Torah tells us that these things are eternal, these things are objectively true, they will always be of value. And that's the significance of having this ikkar, to know that that there's no point at which we can discard any mitzvah, because they always have absolute value. Fine, so I wanted to move in, as I said, to some of the questions that we're going to want to address regarding this ikkar. As was mentioned last week, we spent most of last week talking about this point, that the ninth ikkar is the only ikkar on which there is not just an argument about whether or not it should be a principle of faith, but there's an argument about whether or not it is true. And the Sefer HaIkrim, one of the students of the Ran, Joseph Albo, actually argued that this ikkar, not only is it not an ikkar, but it's not true. If God wanted to, he could come and change the Torah. We discuss, and his main challenge to this ikkar was basically a question of why not? If God wants to, why shouldn't God be able to change it? It's up to God. If he wants to change it, he'll change it. If not, not. He goes through a long discussion of how exactly God would change it, what would have to happen in order to override the Nevuah of Moshe Rabbeinu in such a way that we would actually be obligated to listen. But at the end of the day, he says, you know, it's up to God. If God wants to do it, he'll do it. And if not, then he won't. So we discussed last week the position of the Rambam and why the Rambam's position is certainly within the Rambam's own framework, why it 100% makes sense. I didn't mention this last week. And there are some later thinkers who, not to denigrate the Sefer HaIkrim, but basically have pointed out that the Ikrim as a philosopher was not such a major figure. As a commentary on Chumash, he was a very significant parish on Chumash, but as a philosopher, that he wasn't such a significant person, and there are some who use some very harsh language, said that, you know, he was basically, you know, a tenth-rate philosopher, and said nothing against him. You know, there's things that some, you know, not everyone's good at everything, and that was just not his forte, and that's his, you know, his disagreement with the Rambam. Is it, there's really no reason to defend the Rambam. We understand the Rambam's based on basically the ideas we were explaining last week. We put, you know, why the Rambam's position is well-founded, and to try and explain the position of the Sefer HaIkrim, we felt like there's no need to do that, because he basically, to put it, I don't know, not so nicely, didn't know what he was talking about. But not to get into that, but the Sefer HaIkrim
is the end result.
The Sefer HaIkrim, what do you mean, the end result?
So if I went to Rav Aaron Feldman and I said, who's right? What would he say?
Well,
what would Rav Zakim say?
It gets into many complicated issues, which is, first of which is there a psak? Is there a conclusion when it comes to something, a matter of hashgafa? And it happens to be here that it's not just a matter of hashgafa. There are halachic ramifications of the Yud Gimel Ikrim, and whether or not we paskin like the Rambam that these Yud Gimel Ikrim are the Yud Gimel Ikrim is not something that's discussed very overtly in poskim.
But what about that one point?
So that one point is going to
having a new Torah.
So the truth is that specifically is going to be even harder to find halachic discussion about, because once you say that it's not an ikker, there's really no halachic ramification of whether or not you think it's true or not if you think that it's not an ikker. Meaning, in terms of just the pure halachic discussion, the only halachic ramification is whether or not it's an ikker, right? So if it's not an ikker, so then at that point there's not really going to be much discussion about in terms of the halacha about whether or not you'll say that it's true. But anyways, we generally don't have such a strong, there's you know, never been really any svarim written about, you know, paskening areas of hashgafa. There's a large discussion about whether or not there is such a thing as psak, as halachic conclusions in areas of hashgafa. But to just take it one step back even further, what makes it even more confusing is anyone who takes even a cursory read of the Sefer HaIkrim sees that he had a very different definition of what an ikker is than what the Rambam had. The Rambam Sefer HaIkrim are those things which define the Das HaTorah, which define the values, the principles that the Torah lays out for us. Whereas the Sefer HaIkrim very clearly and overtly understands that what an ikker is that which defines a religion as being a religion. He says there are only three ikrim. He says the three primary components that any religion has to have in order to be a religion. They're not really even, and he asks a number of questions on the Rambam based on his own definition of what an ikker is, very clearly not having the same definition of what an ikker is. So it becomes more difficult to kind of discuss, like, the who's right when they're kind of talking apples and oranges. And so it's the basic answer to your question is it's not such a, there's not such a clear yes or no answer, because there are a lot of different points about, even before we ask the question, we have to figure out, you know, what the context of the conversation. And in terms of bottom line halacha, I only have one story that I can bring in terms of your example. What would Rabbi Aaron Feldman say? I know that there was once one of the people who was involved in this story told me that Rabbi Aaron Feldman once went somewhere for whatever it was. He came back on a Monday morning. I don't know if it was Monday morning. I don't remember Kriyas HaTorah as part of the story. But either way, that he came back and he got back to Baltimore after the Yeshiva Minyan. And he had asked ahead of time to have 9 Bachrim from the Yeshiva not daven with the Yeshiva in order to be able to make a Minyan with him at, you know, like 8:30 or 9 o'clock, whatever time he was getting back to Yeshiva. And of the 9 Bachrim, 8 of them came, and one of them, when he woke up in the morning, forgot that he was supposed to be waiting to daven with the Rosh Yeshiva, and went and davened with the regular Yeshiva minion, so they only had 8 Bachrim in the Rosh Yeshiva. There was a janitor, who was a Jewish janitor, that they wanted to recruit to be the 9th member of their minion. The problem is, you cannot use someone for a minion who is basically the halachic definition of a heretic, which is someone who does not accept the principles of faith. So when the Rosh Yeshiva wanted to confirm that this person could be counted for a minion, so he only asked him 3 questions, not 13. He asked him, do you believe in God? Do you believe God gave the Torah? And do you believe that God, I don't know the exact words that he said, watches what we do, or rewards and punishes, or something like that. He only asked them those 3 questions, which are the 3 Ikrim that the Sefer Ikrim says, and not the 13 questions, which would be necessary according to the Rambam. Now, I don't want to get into why that story is not so conclusive, because there are certain ways in which those 3, in a certain sense, sum up the 13 of the Rambam. The first 5 Ikrim are really about God's existence. The next 4 are really about God giving the Torah. And the next 4 are really about God's hashgacha, God's staying on top of the world. So either way, it's a difficult question to answer. So what's the conclusion? But I want to discuss some of the questions that are asked. The way I heard the story, he did.
Oh, okay.
The way I heard the story, they didn't down with a minion. I don't know how comfortable someone would be telling the Rosh Yeshiva, standing there like, do you believe in God? No, I don't. But fine.
She might work for him.
Exactly. Right. So, the first point, just before we get into this, I just want to mention one kind of empirical point, that the Rambam, as part of his proof for all the Ikrim, he brings psukim, he brings verses, and the Rambam brings a number of verses which seem to say that the Torah will last forever. And then the Rambam concludes with Lo Ish Kael V'Yechaziv, which means that God is not a man that he should be tricky or crooked, right? Meaning God's not gonna say this is forever and then come along later and say it's not. So whether or not you'd understand it had to be that way, Lamaisa, it is that way. God said it's gonna be forever, and God doesn't make jokes, so it's gonna be forever. And there are those who come and challenge the Rambam's sources from the verses. They say, there's sometimes when the Torah uses the word forever and doesn't mean forever. For example, it says by an Eved Ivri who sells himself until Yovel, it says Va'avadu La'olam, which Chazal say means until Yovel, which means until the 50th Jubilee year, at which point everyone goes 3, and Olam means Olam Oshel Yovel, a 50-year cycle in many areas is viewed as a microcosm of an eternity, and therefore the word Olam doesn't always mean forever. Sajigon has a reason in his Emunus Videos the response to that argument, why he feels the term Olam does imply forever in many contexts. I don't want to get into all of the nitty-gritty of that, but basically the Rambam has what he would call, just the facts on the ground before we get into any, reasoning, logic behind it, that he says, listen, at the end of the day, the Torah says Laru Vaninu Ad Olam, Lasos is called Divrei Torah Zos, that this Torah is for us and our children forever. And that's that. Fine.
And Rabbi, when we're talking about the Torah, we're talking about Torah Nevi'im and Ketuvim, right?
Well, so, no, we're going to get actually one of the points we're going to discuss. We are very specifically talking about just the Torah. And that's going to be very important to...
Five books
of Moses.
Okay,
so that's all. I'm just going to list out all the questions. We're only going to answer some of them. Maybe some of them I'll just mention the answer. We're not going to go through. One question that's asked is that the Sheva Mitzvos B'nei Noah, there were the 7 Noahide laws, one of which was that on top of the specific list of things which are allowed and not allowed, one of the things was that Adam HaRishon was not allowed to eat meat. And Noah was allowed to eat meat. Meat was permitted to Noah and his descendants, whereas it had been forbidden before then. So says of Yosef Albo, so you see that God's commandment can go from that which used to be not allowed can now be allowed. So if something, so how does that work? If you say that all the commandments are objective, you see that they're not objective. So What?
Pre-Torah.
So we'll see very clearly that, you know, the answer is somewhat self-evident, but we're going to try and bring it out in terms of our discussion. Mila was given to Avram Avinu. So you see that, you know, there's room to add. Even though Avram was given a mitzvah, you know, it wasn't complete. There's still room to give more. And that's the end, and there's, you know, so to speak, room for improvement. There's a Maimer Chazal, which says, Kol Sifrei Nevi'im Asidim Libatel, Chutz Mi Sefer Yeshua Megillah, that all of the works of the prophets are going to be nullified, except for the Sefer Yeshua and the Megillah, Megillah's Esther. So seemingly you see that they can be canceled. There's two Yesodos in the Rambam's own list, which seem like they are temporary Yesodos, namely the Iker of Bias HaMashiach, the fact that that Mashiach will come. So that's, once Mashiach comes, that seemingly won't be an Iker Emun anymore. You don't have to believe that Mashiach is going to come anymore once he comes. And the Yesod of Tchias HaMesim, the fact that there will be a resurrection of the dead. So once God resurrected the dead, seemingly there's no more need to believe that God will resurrect the dead. So you see that those are temporary things. The Ikrim themselves, even in the Rambam's own structure, that there's room for them to change. There's a Maimer Chazal. This is one of the ones that we're not going to discuss. I'll just throw out really quickly the basic response, but it says, Mitzos Betelos L'Asad Lavo. There's a Gemara that says that from the fact that you don't have to put tzitzis on the tachrichim of a mace, on the shrouds that a person is buried in, you don't have to put tzitzis on them. So the Gemara says, you see that Mitzos Betelos L'Asad Lavo, that Mitzos are going to be nullified by in the future. So the normal understanding of that Gemara, the normal understanding, what? He's eventually going to be, so the normal understanding of that Gemara means that when he's resurrected, he's going to stand up out of his grave, and he's going to be wearing these shrouds, and they won't have tzitzis on them, and that's not a problem.
Do you sleep in tzitzis?
No, but I'm not chayiv in tzitzis.
He's taking a long shluffy.
Right, when he wakes up, what's going to happen?
Well, what happens when you woke up this morning and I didn't have tzitzis on it?
But did you wear a four-cornered garment without tzitzis when you slept?
Are
I hope not.
In four-cornered?
Yes, yes they are. It's a talus, in fact. The only one of them is a talus, but yeah, you bury a person in a talus and you cut off one of the corners of the tzitzis so it doesn't have tzitzis on it when he's buried. But the normal understanding of the Gemara, I don't even know if you call it the normal, but one understanding, the simplest understanding of the Gemara is that when he gets up out of the grave, he's going to be wearing a four-cornered garment without tzitzis. So that seems to not be a problem. The Gemara says, that's right, it's not a problem because mitzos betelos lasid lavo, that mitzos are going to be nullified, lasid lavo, taken to mean in the time of Tchias HaMesim. The Rajba very directly and overtly and explicitly has a different understanding than Gemara, which he says it does not mean lasid lavo, the time of resurrection. It means, which is what Corey was kind of arguing, while he's dead. The point of the Gemara is that you don't have to put tzitzis on the person to bury him in them, because while he is dead, he has no chiyuv and mitzvos. Meaning that you don't have to, that even the living don't have to be concerned about the obviously he himself isn't doing any mitzvos because he can't, but even the living can dress him up in a four-cornered baggage without garment without tzitzis, because we even the living don't have to worry about him keeping mitzvos while he is dead. Alright, that's a side detail. Another one, there's a medrash that says, Lama nikre shma chazir. Why is a pig called a chazir? Sha'asid HaKadosh Baruch Hu l'hachzir al Yisrael. Because in the future, God is going to return it to the Jewish people. So he's going to make the pig kosher. Pigs in the laws of Lava will be kosher. So seemingly, right, also right now to eat pig, and in the future it's going to be mutter. Sounds like mitzvos will change. So again, this is not one of the ones I want to get into, but just the one sentence response is basically quoted by the Chasam Sofer, that the reason that an animal is kosher or not kosher, the Chasam Sofer says, is that the kosher signs are not just what indicates if an animal is kosher or not kosher, but that is what makes it kosher or not kosher. What defines it as being not kosher is lacking the kosher signs. And says the Chasam Sofer, what that Gemara means, lasid lavo, that the chazir is going to be kosher, is that it will start chewing its cud. and it starts chewing its cud, so then it's a kosher animal because now it fits the signs. It's not a change in halacha. It's going to be a change in the chazir. It's going to be the change is not going to be in the Torah. The change is going to be in the chazir. All right.
They actually found an animal in the Amazon.
Yeah, I heard about this.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, really?
It's related to pig, but it's porcine, but it chews its cud.
Yeah. All right. So, kosher bacon. Kosher bacon.
There you go.
Fine. The Mabit in the Sefer Beis Elkim so asks that in any machlokus, the machmir, the opinion who's stringent, who holds that, you know, there's two opinions, two chum argue about whether something is permitted or forbidden. Wow, we're almost out of time, we have to hurry here. Whether something is permitted or forbidden, so according to the one who says it's forbidden, the guy who's saying it's permitted is subtracting from the Torah. And according to the one who says that it's permitted, the one who says it's forbidden is adding to the Torah. So in every machlokas chachamim, you seemingly have additions and subtractions to the Torah. At least, whoever's right, the one who's wrong is either adding or subtracting. And the Rambam included in his Iker the fact that there will not be any additions to the Torah in the Torah Shabbat Pet either. So we're not going to have time to go through everything inside just because we're running short on time. The first two pages that we have, or I guess really the second and third page that we have here, is where the Sefer Ikrim goes through his point that meat used to be forbidden for other Marishon and his descendants until Noah. Then it was changed. He says that you see from here, Araya, that godly, divine systems of law can be changed, at least partially in some things. And he says at the end of chapter 15, this bar calls that, according to everything he explained, that it's Efsher, that something could be mutter and then become usser, and something could be usser and then become mutter, and you see that's the, so why can't it be the same thing with the Torah? So just very briefly, there's a number of places we could look to bring out this point. I just chose the Malbim because he says it very eloquently. The Malbim asks a question. He says that why is it that, you know, God, there are seven mitzvos for Bnei Noach, and God piled mitzvos upon the Jewish people. It almost sounds like, you know, Bnei Noach, they only need seven mitzvos. The Jewish people, you know, they're a pretty bad case. You know, they need a lot more fixing for them to you know, catch up. And so he brings, there are some who say, they bring this analogy that he doesn't like, says, some who say that no, God did it as a favor to us. It's like someone who goes to the doctor, and the doctor says you can take, you know, gives him a list of 10 medicines he could take. And that way, if he can't find one of them, he'll, you know, be able to find another one. So he's making it easier for us. Points out, that's not what God said. God didn't say, here's a list of 613 mitzvos, choose one. God says, here's a list of 613 mitzvos, and do them all. So it'd be like a doctor, instead of giving you one medicine that you need to take, gives you a list of 10 and says you need to take all 10. So the Malbim says, let's see if we can start to where in here he really here on the fourth line down in the left side column says, Kilo Amar Hashem Asa. Okay, really, let's go to the Ulam Hatshuva. It's about eight lines down. Ulam Hatshuva, the answer is She'enu Dome Hashlemus Shahayu Masigim Alide Zain Mitzvos Be'Noach. The Shlemus, the personal completion of the person that came through the Mitzvos Be'Noach, is not the same Shahayu Rak Shlemus L'Chaye Ha'olam Hazeh U'L'Chayim HaNimusiyim. There was Shlemus for this world and for basically the conventions of running a functional society. It was Nimusiyim, it was culture. It was to create a cohesive culture. Mash Enkin Shlemus She'yasigu Alide Kiyo Mitzvos HaTorah U'L'Hasig Asher Nitzli U'Ma'al Alokis. As opposed to that which the mitzvos of the Torah were not just to create a livable society, but were giving a way to achieve godliness, to achieve a shlemus of a godly, divine way. So that required much more, because not because Baal Yisrael needed more, but because they were accomplishing much more. The mitzvos of Bnei Noach are forming a rubric of building a society of Olam Hazeh, in this world. The Torah is creating the divine reality, which is the true nature of connecting to God. That's what the Torah is. The Torah is an entirely different species. Then, so when God changes the mitzvah, changes from the mitzvahs Bnei Noach, it's permitted, it's not permitted, whatever it is. It's defining how they're going to, according to the, you know, the nature of the culture as it is, how they are best going to be able to form their society. Those things are, in a certain sense, I mean, I don't know, I won't call them the best objective way to do that or not, but at the end of the day, it's an entirely different ballgame than what we're talking about when God gave the Torah. The attempt was not to recreate the seven mitzvot b'nei Noach in a different way. It was an entirely different system with an entirely different purpose. It wasn't canceling seven mitzvot b'nei Noach and giving a different way to achieve the same result. It's an entirely different thing. I think this is the explanation in, there's a halacha that by mitzvos b'nei Noach, there is no halacha of Yarag val Yavor. There's no halacha that for the Shevet mitzvos b'nei Noach that they have to give up their life rather than transgress. By Jews, what's also true in general, we don't have a mitzvah. We don't have to give up our life except for the Gimel Chamuros, the three major category headings of murder, adultery, and idolatry. But by the Jews, there's a specific verse necessary to teach that. There's a verse of V'chai Bahem, which teaches you should live by them and not you should die by them, which teaches that by all mitzvos, except for those three, that if someone says to you to violate them or I'll kill you, that you violate it and you don't let yourself be killed. So by the Torah, you needed a verse to tell you to violate it and to not be killed. By the mitzvos b'nei Noach, you didn't. Why? Because the mitzvos b'nei Noach, they're building the practical instructions of how to build a functional society. Is there any reason that you should die for that? Is there any reason if someone says, do this or I'll kill you, that you shouldn't do it? The whole point is to build a livable society. If you have to kill yourself in order to keep just the corner cases of whatever it is, there's nothing objectively valuable about it that I should care about, a one-time violation in order to save my own skin. As opposed to the Torah, a person could have thought that every single mitzvah in the Torah I should give my life for, because every single mitzvah in the Torah is not just, a convention of what's, the best way to build society. It is objective value of being the Ratzon of Hashem, and a person would think that therefore you should give the life. Therefore, the Torah has to teach by those things that a person should give does not need to give their life for it. I just want to get through one more thing. I guess we're not going to get through all of the questions, but the question from that all of the other prophets are going to be canceled. So we're going to go through really quickly the Meshech Chachma. The Or Samaach, same author, gives a very brief, concise answer in which he just throws off a number of Marmakomos. So I put the Marmakomos here just to go through it really quickly. The Rambam paskins this halacha in Hilchos Megillah that Kol Sifrei Nevi'im V'Kol Ktuvim Asidim Libatel Limos Mashiach, all of them are going to be nullified except for Megillas Esther. And it's going to stay just like Chamishei Chumashei Torah and the Torah Shebaal Peh. So how that seems like the Torah is changing. So the Or Samaach references the Gemara Nedarim, which says, Amar of Abba Barabi Chanina, Il Mali Chato Yisrael Lo Nitan Lehem El Chamishei Chumashei Torah V'Sefer Yeshua Bilvad. Had the Jewish people not sinned, the only thing they would have gotten would have been just the Chamishei Chumashei Torah and the Book of Yoshua. Why Yoshua? She'arka Shal Yisrael. Because the Savior Yoshua gives you the way to separate, split up Eretz Yisrael, a necessary conclusion to the Torah, which says that you're going to divide it up into Nachalos. Those Nachalos, those inheritances, are spelled out in Savior Yoshua. But other than that, there would have been no other Torah. And says the Gemara says that was only necessary because the Jewish people sinned. I'm going to skip this Rashi here just for the purposes of time, but the Rambam himself in Mor Nevokim, the Or Samaach doesn't reference this, but just demonstrate. The Rambam himself really makes this point in Mor Nevokim. He says, Kol Navi Mimenu Sheba Achrei Moshe Rabbeinu Kvar Yadata Lashon Masaos Kulam. Every Navi who came after Moshe Rabbeinu, we know what their intended purpose was. V'shehem Hayum B'maiman Mochichim Levnei Adam. Their job was to rebuke the Korim Osam Torah Moshe, and to direct them, to call them to the Torah of Moshe. Ma'aynim a'anotam imenu maftichim al-shehis minachara, to cow those who were straying from it, to tell them the bad things that are going to happen to them, to reward and to encourage those who are keeping it. The whole point of all of the Nevi'im was only to substantiate the Nebuah of Moshe Rabbeinu. La'asad lavo, it's not going to be necessary to to have the Sfarim of the Nevi'im, their whole purpose was just to encourage people and direct people to the Torah of Moshe. But Lasad Lavo, when it's going to be so clear, there's not going to be any need for rebuke to keep the Torah of Moshe. So then those Sfarim will be batal, those Sfarim will be nullified, and will be left with just the Chumash. And Megillas Esther, it's a separate discussion, maybe a Purim Torah about, Torah about Purim, that, about why that one will stay. But that's exactly the point. Chamishi Chumshi Torah, they are eternal because they came from Moshe Rabbeinu. That is the whole picture of what a Kadosh Baruch Hu wanted. The Sifrei Nevi'im are just there to uphold the Torah of Moshe Rabbeinu. All right, there's a couple of things we didn't get to, but we're already over time. So we'll stop here. And Yeshua Tov, everyone's coming.